Chapter 8, Stories of Faith. Leaving the airport parking lot, I immediately began to take in all the scenery. There were people standing in the middle of the street selling small bags of water, juice, peanuts, and fruit, and flea market-type stands set up all along the roadside, with people selling everything from jewelry and clothes to name-brand shoes. Then I saw what appeared to be hundreds of homemade tents covered with black plastic in a large open field, right in the middle of town. "Mike, what are those people doing there?" I asked. After consulting with Danilio for several minutes, Mike turned to me and started telling those people's story. A large banana grower has large plantations, and it's customary to use the campesinos, the country people who are poorly educated and cheap labor. They sent them into the banana plantations with a pesticide called Nemagon, spraying the bananas without any personal protective equipment and no information that it could be hazardous. Shortly thereafter, these workers came down with all kinds of illnesses. The birth defects were horrible. In Costa Rica, they have a museum of fetuses in jars of the birth defects. There were lawsuits brought about in all the countries, and they were settled everywhere except Nicaragua. The tent city was a protest. There was still more court action. They wanted help. After Mike had finished, I was speechless. It wasn't long before we left the city and were on a more rural road. Oscar seemed to slow down and swerve to avoid every pothole that was in the road, even with oncoming traffic. It didn't take me long to get used to his driving. As I continued to peer out my window from the back seat, I noticed along the roadside that people had built homes made of wooden sticks covered with plastic sheeting. I asked Mike who let these people build their homes so close to the road. Mike told me these people are very poor, do not own any land, and basically don't own anything but what's inside of that shelter. These squatters work to gather the sticks to make the frame, and then save the money they earn by working in the fields or even gathering firewood for other families. When they have enough money, they buy the plastic sheeting. Sometimes the plastic sheeting is donated by the government. If they are lucky and a piece of cardboard blows off a passing truck, then they can cover the dirt floor. Either way, it's wet when it rains, though with the cardboard floor, it's not as cold. Mike then mentioned that when the city feels like there are too many of these people along the roadside, it will send a bulldozer and clean up the roadside in one day, piling up all the debris. These people generally have only minutes to gather everything they own, or at least what they have stored inside of their shelter. Then, once the bulldozer is gone, they start the endless process all over again. I could hardly bear to hear any more as Mike continued by telling the next story. A boy and a girl, they were coming up to the Bible study, lived in this little old cardboard mess down there up against the airport fence. Danilio's mom wanted us to donate just a few sheets of tin from our work project to help out this family. We went down there, and it, the shelter, was a mess. One little old nasty piece of foam that the parents slept in, and over top of it, there was like a hammock that the two kids slept in, a little boy about 10 and a little girl about 12. I couldn't stand up straight in there. So we went down there and said, "Yeah, look, we can do something about this." We tore it down and shot a black coral out of there, a very poisonous snake. It, the shelter, was just cardboard and junk. It was essentially trash. It was constructed of trash. As we passed yet another group of these shelters, my heart almost broke, now knowing these people's struggles just to make it through one day. But even more than that, how we as Americans take so much for granted. Even people who think they have nothing in America are rich compared to these people. All most people seem to think about is themselves and having fun, all while a world of people are struggling every day just to survive, much less enjoy life. As we continued on the 3-hour trip northward into the mountains, Mike told of the city dump where our church's mission team had built a feeding shelter for the people living there. Bewildered, I asked Mike if he meant for the workers. The next part of his story was hard for me to understand. The feeding shelter was for the community of recyclers, people who go through the dump searching for tin, metal, or anything that they can sell. There's one place, I've been by there, just walking. They salvage plastic and wash plastic by hand in a wash tub and hang it up on a clothesline, and people buy it. These people own practically nothing in this world. Mike explained that the feeding shelter was built so the elderly and the children can get at least one meal a day, which is normally rice and a piece of bread. A lot of times it would be a tomato and an egg. It's better than starvation. There was a family whose kids would come to the feeding program and Bible study. And, of course, the dump is their playground, too. Someone had thrown rat poison out, or there had been rat poison in the trash. It was pink, and the kids just associated the pink with candy and ate it. One of the kids started getting violently ill, and the mother took the child and went to the hospital. Well, about the time that child was dying, the father comes in with another one of their children, and about the time that child died, a neighbor came in with their last child, and that child died. They lost all of their children. And some years ago, there was a dental X-ray machine thrown away. The part that contained the radioactive material was like a ball, and whoever the recycler was managed to break this ball. The dust, the radioactive material inside, it glows. They were superstitious, and they rubbed it all over themselves, and they glowed and all that. It killed several children and gave some other people radiation poisoning. After Mike told these stories, I remembered a lady at church telling me a story of the dump. Her husband had, in fact, been on the mission team that had built the feeding shelter. Though she didn't explain it in as much detail as Mike, she told it from her husband's viewpoint. I retold the story I had been told. When you first see the dump, all you see is a large mound of trash. Then, as you get closer, you notice that it's moving. Getting even closer, you realize it's hundreds of people moving on the trash, scouring for food scraps, clothing, and anything they can use to make improvements to their living shelter. After I finished, everyone remained quiet, like each was still picturing this in their mind. Or maybe they were like me, overwhelmed with the sight of the poverty along the roadside as we passed. Then I began to wonder, if life around the city of Managua was this bad, what would it be like up near the mountain town of Matiwa? Would it be this bad? And if so, would a pedestrian bridge even make a dent of an impact on their lives? We were less than an hour away from the town of Matiwa, and while Mike and Avery exchanged their views on world politics, I continued to process everything I had already seen and heard. It was almost overwhelming. I thought I was prepared, but I'm not sure anything could have prepared me for this experience. Breaking a brief period of silence, Mike shared with us several stories of faith. Mike did not know that in my vision from God in March, Jesus had instructed me to go back and start telling the stories I will give to you. At that time, I had no idea what his statement meant, but now it was becoming much clearer. Many of Mike's stories came from a time when the country of Nicaragua was at war with itself. He told a story that came from his Nicaraguan friend, Pastor Henry. Henry is Costa Rican, and being Costa Rican, he traveled pretty freely preaching during the wartime because he was a foreigner and not involved in the Civil War. Henry told about a family. The father and son were combatants. The other side, their enemy, went to the home to kill them, the father and the son. The family was alerted to the approaching enemy, and the father and the son ran, leaving the mother and small children at home in the little shack. The shack was surrounded by the combatants, and they just chopped it to pieces with automatic weapon fire. When they stopped shooting, they went in and found the woman and her children around a little table with a Bible, praying. They, the bullets, hadn't cut a hair. They were unharmed. Then Mike began to tell the next story. There was a lady. Her name was Ruby. Ruby was a little black lady, about as wide as she was tall. She was from the Bluefields, which is the Caribbean side of Nicaragua. The black folks over there speak English. They are descendants of English slaves. Ruby had just tremendous faith. Ruby died last spring. She's been dead almost a year now. Ruby would pray for you with just an uncanny personal knowledge of your needs. Some people criticized Ruby. People would go by there and she would pray for them and they would leave money. She lived on faith. She had no means of income. She prayed for people. The Lord sent people. She prayed for them and they left her offerings and supported her. I don't care how you believe. I knew her, and she was just a tremendous woman. As I said, Ruby was from the Bluefields, the Caribbean side, and the road to go over there is absolutely horrible. I have been as far as Bonanza on the road, and that's halfway across, and is over 12 hours. There are holes in the road big enough to swallow a truck. If you get up to 35 miles per hour on that cross-country road, you are flying. The means of transportation for years has been riverboat. Ruby wanted to go home to visit from Managua. They would go down to Lake Nicaragua, 10th largest freshwater lake in the world, and get on a riverboat. The riverboat would go down the San Juan River and then back up the coast. This was the route that the 49ers took to California. Mark Twain took that route, would come up the San Juan River, and then it was, I think, a 17-mile stagecoach ride to the Pacific and get on a ship and go on up to California. At one point in time, that was the shortest route, the quickest route. Ruby was on a large riverboat. They were on their way down the river, several people sitting on benches, so on and so forth. Ruby said that she was sitting beside a little girl, 10 or 11 years old. She said they went around the bend in the river, and a woman came out of a little small shack on the riverbank with what appeared to be a dishpan and waved it in the air. Ruby said another woman beside her waved back. Ruby said she didn't know why, but she said, "You shouldn't ought have done that." Well, they went around another bend in the river, and there was machine gun fire from both sides of the river. It, the waving dishpan, had been a signal. Ruby said that she just grabbed the little girl and rolled down on top of her. She didn't realize it at the time, but the boat's pilot had been killed, and the Sandinista soldiers that were on the boat held her nephew at gunpoint and made him stand up and navigate the boat while it was taking all the machine gun fire. It was either do that or they were going to kill him. Ruby said they got on through the machine gun fire. It was total chaos on the boat. She said during the machine gun fire, the Lord had told her, "Raise your hand to me." She said she raised her hand in the air. She said she felt something hit her hand. She just grasped it. Anyway, after they went around the river and got on away from the gunfire, she said there had been a group of Mexican laborers in the front of the boat. They were all killed. She said that people were just running all over the boat, and said someone came to her and said, "Senora, you are horribly wounded." She said, "No, I beg your pardon. I serve a great and powerful God." The chaos and the screaming and wailing continued, and someone else came by and said, "Senora, you are horribly wounded." She said, "No, I beg your pardon. I serve a great and powerful God." They came to the point, and she said the Lord told her, "You can lower your hand now." She said she opened her eyes and the lady beside her, who had waved at the woman on the riverbank, was dead. She said she looked in her hand and she had a bullet in her hand. After Mike had finished telling us those two stories, I continued to stare at him for a brief moment. I could tell he truly believed every word he was saying, every single detail. There was no doubt in my mind that God had protected these individuals from harm. The trip to Motiwaf had been over 3 hours, and unfortunately, there were no fast food restaurants anywhere. The gas station we had stopped at was closed, but thankfully, attendants were still selling drinks from the outside coolers. Then I felt bad, remembering the only food items I had packed for the trip were crackers and Fig Newtons. Even though I wanted to buy Avery a nice meal to show my appreciation for her being here, this was all I had to offer. For some reason, it didn't seem to matter to her. A good meal was not the only thing. Since our bridge was not yet an official Bridges to Prosperity project, Avery could not turn in any of the expenses from this trip. This meant I had to agree up front to cover all of her associated expenses, meaning meals, lodging, and a round-trip airline ticket from Guatemala to Nicaragua. Knowing this was the open door for this project I had prayed, I walked through it, not fully knowing where I was going to get the extra money to pay for the $500 airline ticket. Then I remembered the mission team meeting last year when I had asked how we were going to raise the money for the bridge. Mike looked at me and said, "Have faith. God will provide the money." My immediate reply was, "But someone has to give the money, right?" He simply agreed and smiled, seeing my faith was still based on seeing and not believing. So, not knowing anything else to do, I had prayed. I prayed that week for my dad to give me a donation for the trip, even for a specific amount. Then, on Friday, my dad called me and we met for lunch in Blythewood. I told him the dates for my trip and everything I hoped to accomplish at the bridge site. He was very excited and even mentioned he wished he had done more when he was my age, but now felt he was too old. We continued talking in the restaurant's parking lot. Then, as he went to get in his truck to leave, he suddenly stepped back out. He had his checkbook. He wrote me a check for $500. Avery's plane ticket was $503. After hearing Mike's stories and seeing God move in the lives of these Nicaraguan people, and then remembering my own story, I began to wonder if most people in today's society are just too busy with their daily routines to see God move. If God moved in their life, would they even notice? Would I have? And receiving the answer to my question, am I called, while on a flight en route to a developing country, to help these people? Well, maybe that was the answer to that question, at least for me, anyways.